Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 387th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, and now the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians.
Oh, aren't we important?
We are. Well, when you say we, is it the royal we, or do you actually mean you and I? Because I'm not willing to speak to your importance.
No, and I am just bowing to your importance about getting a new job, which I have not haven't had a new job in, 30 years.
Yeah. Proving that it's very hard to fire people from a university.
Yes, it is. God bless having tenure.
Thank God.
So today we're going to delve into a very recent tools for practice that you and some of your even smarter colleagues put together.
And that's setting the bar pretty low. These are smart people, yeah. So they're more than just smarter than me.
Yeah. And so we're going to delve into the issue of opioids, which given the opioid crisis, I think it would be very valuable. We're not going to talk about the crisis, but we are going to talk a little bit about the evidence.
Right. And so this was done by Joey Ton, who's a PharmD. And you know what they're like, James.
We won't say anything. Difficult to deal with, yeah.
Yeah. And he's the opposite of that, actually. Oh. And Danielle Perry, who is a nurse and a master's science student. So she's on our team. Oh, actually, Joey and her are both on the team, and they do a lot of our evidence work now. Mm-hmm. And we asked the question, because we had been working on neuropathic pain in relation to the cannabinoid work, the other options for neuropathic pain came up. And of course, opioids are kind of often considered, or hopefully considered, the fallback position. But we wanted to look at the evidence and see whether you could kind of support that position and if it had any utility.
Yeah, and it's always so important to do that because, you know, even going back and looking for, you know, what is the evidence for opioids in, just any sort of chronic pain, whether it be cancer pain and all those sorts of things, it's often difficult to tease that data and look at it and put it into a context because, as you know, probably 20 or 30 years ago when, you know, we decided to add in the fact that maybe pain should be a vital sign, you know, it was very cleverly manipulated, I think, for us to push the use of opioids more. And the evidence is, one, we have an opioid crisis, and it's important to know how effective these are.
Yeah, exactly. And as you might expect, it's a little surprising how effective and ineffective they are. Now, I can't recall if we've talked about the space trial, but if we haven't, we'll need to talk about that sometime soon. And that's the trial that compared treatment options for patients with OA and back pain,
yes,
using opioid medications versus the kind of classic TCAs, gabapentins, that kind of thing, right. And I won't spoil it too much by saying, as not a surprise, opioids didn't stand out. And furthermore, there was just recently a large systematic review meta-analysis published in, and I know I'm not going to say this right because it's a German word, but Schmerz. And it sounds like a joke, I know, but they actually do incredibly good systematic reviews. Anyway, and in that they had all of the head-to-head comparisons of opioids versus other drugs for a whole variety of conditions, and again found that really opioids added really nothing more than what, like, for example, in OA, what NSAIDs might do. So in the context of that, let's move on to neuropathic pain. And most of these are going to be placebo-controlled studies, and there are four systematic reviews that we looked at that had anywhere from 5 to 31 randomized control trials with anywhere from 236 to 1,769 patients followed for 4 to 12 weeks. And when we're talking chronic pain, I know many of you will kind of go 12 weeks, that's it. That's long.
Yeah, and I also find it interesting that, you know, to do a study of a painkiller, you need to study over 1,000 people. I mean, I think, you know, it must tell you that you're not looking for a very big benefit unless you're truly doing it because you want to find out sort of the adverse effects of it. but I well, don't.
Well, these are the pooled RCTs. So that's how many, the total number of patients and 31 RCTs. So the RCTs themselves are actually quite small. That's why they often fail to show a difference, because as you're suggesting, the effects are smaller than we think. And therefore these trials, which can have as little as kind of 30 people in them, frequently
right.
won't.
But if you had, in regards to even just 30 people, if you had a really effective treatment,
absolutely,
30, you could show easily statistical significance if it was that effective. And so when you go to that sort of stuff, and then even because you have to do the systematic reviews where you make it so that you've got this many thousands, you know, hundreds or thousands of people, and it's still sometimes tricky. It tells you something.
It is tricky. So let's talk a little bit about these patients. So they're kind of in their 60s, which is what you'd expect for neuropathic mm-hmm. pain. And then they're all versus placebo, and the types of pain are diabetic neuropathy. That's almost always number one. Things like postherpetic neuralgia and phantom limb pain. Mm-hmm. Those would be the primary ones. And they, you know, the old expression, go big or go home. So there are low dose studies of, you know, a morphine equivalent of 7.5 milligrams a day. Mm-hmm. But there were lots of studies in here where the doses were 180 to 240 milligrams per day.
Yeah, which is that's a good dose of morphine. You certainly wouldn't want to take it. You wouldn't want to start
the first
at that dose. Yeah.
Yeah. You'd
stop breathing.
It would be so high risk to start anywhere even near there. So, these are patients probably who are already on some or titrated up over a relatively long period of time. And just as a reminder, you know, when we're reflecting on opioids, the new guidelines are recommending kind of a 90 milligrams a day as your ceiling dose. Mm-hmm. So these are starting out at double that.
Whenever I see these sort of thresholds, that 90 is somewhat made up. If not like completely, I'm not aware of any evidence.
I think it was more on the idea that, you know, people who are on these higher doses, if you look at a kind of correlation curve, mm-hmm. as you go in higher doses, more bad things happen.
You rarely get, if you double the dose, you don't get double the effect. So it's, kind of chasing yourself. Sometimes you go, well, I think it's a little bit better. Well, why don't you try a bit more? And then you kind of get caught in a tricky situation. But so anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so and you know, opioids have that added crazy effect of actually changing your pain threshold, mm-hmm. Making you kind of have an as exaggerated response to pain. So they're a mixed bag by any standard. But let's get into the effect. So it's not that they don't work. We don't want to say that. So moderate pain relief, that's at least a 30% improvement in your pain.
Yeah. And that's the typical sort of pain relief that many of the studies that we presented in the past have.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if it was 100% improvement? You almost never see that, or even 50%. But 30% is, I think most people would suggest, clinically relevant, right?
Yeah. And that's kind of what we consider a moderate improvement. Mm-hmm. You'll see some that go as little as 10%, which isn't very reliable. Mm-hmm. And then 50% is what's recommended now that these studies should be targeting. It's interesting, not a lot report on that, but that's considered a significant improvement in pain, or a large improvement in mm-hmm. pain. But most, as you pointed out, do this kind of 30%, or they use something called a patient global impression of change scale. Mm-hmm. And so these patients are often 7 points, they can be 9, they can be 3, but it's, is your pain the same? And that would be the center point. So that would be a 4, mm-hmm. and then gradually down to 1, it's a lot worse, or all the way up to 7, it's a lot better. And so in this time they set a moderate pain relief as much or very much improved, mm-hmm. on the patient global impression of change scale. So who gets there? So now here we're already, James, doing a bit of a gamish of different scales so you have to realize that that's where we're at, and that's the best it's going to get.
And is gamish like a potpourri?
Yes, it is. It's a potpourri.
Yeah,
if you like, yeah, with, you know, a little bit of water in there and a candle.
A little bit of that, the other thing.
So morphine, when we were looking at morphine, and again, remember those big doses that some of these studies used, it was 63% got to that level of pain improvement versus 36. Mm-hmm. So that's a number needed to treat of around 4.
Which in pain is not too bad. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, it's not pretty
brilliant, reasonable. But it's certainly as good as you're going to see with many things.
Right, and so and that could be added on therapy or isolated its own. So this is oxycodone as monotherapy or add on, and it was 44% versus 27 number needed to treat 6. Mm-hmm. If you teased it out into the monotherapy or the add on therapy. Monotherapy had an NNT of 5 and add-on had an NNT of 8.
Yeah. And I was going to add in, and what's important is, we've talked about this in the past, is it's nice to know the sort of number needed to treat, but what you really want to also have a bit of a feel is, what's the background on placebo? Now,
yes.
You know, so you know, you're one out of four or one out of three people who say they are better are getting better either from placebo and the placebo effect, for which I think there is... I would say there's definitely a placebo effect for pain, but yeah. but the number of people who benefit on the placebo group is not just the placebo effect. It's many other things, and so it tells you that you got to be very careful because I was going to say here, if a person has responded, it's a 50-50 chance. It's not because of the drug.
Always you with your hopeful messages.
Me with my numbers, but it's it's
your
important.
Messages
yeah.
of hope.
Yeah.
Even when you think you've done well by the patient, you probably haven't.
Yes. Have a nice day.
Boy, you should be a motivational speaker. And let's move on to, yeah. There's other studies, of course, because I told you there was a number of systematic mm-hmm. reviews. So there's another one that looked at a 33% improvement, which is basically mm-hmm. the same thing. And they looked at pooling morphine and oxycodone together. And these numbers you'll see are almost identical, 57% versus 34, mm-hmm. number needed to treat 5.
Yeah.
We performed a meta-analysis of their data. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't look at, so remember, we've talked about this a ton, James, mm-hmm. and what we want is how many get to a meaningful difference, mm-hmm. And we've given that, and what is the actual change in the pain score with this drug versus placebo. So we actually did the meta-analysis here ourselves, and as you know, most pain studies, they're starting somewhere around a 6. Mm-hmm. Placebo gets you somewhere around 0.5 to 1. And this adds another 1.2 mm-hmm. on in a change in pain scale. So if they were at a 6 and placebo got them, let's say, 0.8, this adds 1.2 more over and above placebo.
Right.
Change in that pain score.
And typically when you look at things like Tylenol, sometimes you don't even see a change. But with NSAIDs, you know, it's sometimes up to as much as 1.2, but it's often in the, you know, the 0.7 or 0.8.
Yeah, that's
change.
Right.
So, you know, again, these drugs definitely have an effect, and, you know, an easy ballpark number to remember is what you talked about, is about 50 to 60% will get better from, or will improve on the narcotic, and, you know, somewhere between 25 and 35% got better on placebo.
That's exactly yeah. right. So it's kind of, and you see these coming out again and again with these studies, and you're right, the changes that you'd see with, let's say, an amitriptyline or for OA and NSAID yeah. would be very similar to these kind of numbers, yeah. kind of around a 1. And remember that in this study, we had a lot of patients who were on whopping doses. As you indicated, you don't get like something like a 0.8 change from 10 milligrams of morphine BID, and then when you go to 20 milligrams BID, you don't go from that 10 to a 20 reduction no. in pain. It doesn't double. It's actually a very small incremental change. In fact, many opioid studies have struggled to show any difference with increases in dosing.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, just from a pharmacological perspective, if you give enough, you will get, you know, complete pain control, but that is also the equivalent of a narcotic induced coma.
Yeah, exactly. You're just sedating them,
and
you know, we can talk about this in managing pain. You have to set the proper parameters for the patient of their expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So many patients will say up front they're hoping they can get complete removal of their pain. So it's so important to say to them, our goal in therapy is not to entirely remove pain, because that would take, you know, a profound amount of medications and a lot of adverse events. What we're trying to do is reduce pain to a place where it's not significantly impacting your life.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk a tiny bit about the other things like function. So, you know, are they able to return to work activities and get better sleep and enjoy life more and all of those things? Surprisingly, a lot of that's unclear. There was some looking at function. Did function improve? And some of them had changes of 0.7 to 1.7 versus placebo, but
and again, not on a 10-point scale.
Yeah, on a 10-point scale, but very difficult to know, not seen consistently. And as far as mood or waking from sleep, or mood or walking measures, like now that you've taken this, can you walk faster? All of those kind of things. Really, no benefits seen there.
And not in all these cases, it's not, you know, the primary endpoint that they're almost all looking is a visual analog scale. So it's nice that they sometimes look at these other endpoints because I think they're clinically extremely relevant. But, you know, often they're very difficult things to measure.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So this is, at least there is something for function here, which often for many of them, we don't have anything. So, but you can expect, it would be reasonable to assume that if function goes, if function improves with pain in other studies, and it would probably improve, but it's harder to show a difference in much research. Let's talk about that. We've talked about the potential upsides. Given the limitations, let's talk about the downsides. So when you look at drugs like morphine and oxycodone, they're hard to tolerate, particularly at higher doses. So even at kind of moderate doses, 1 in 11 to 12 will have to quit because they can't tolerate the adverse events. And the adverse events are very common. So constipation, for example, happens for 1 in every 4 to 5. Dizziness for 1 in every 8 over and above placebo, drowsiness for 1 in every 6 to 7, nausea 1 in every 6 more, and vomiting 1 in every 12 more. So these are the numbers needed to harm it. It's obviously these have a lot of adverse events, and the numbers that separate from placebo are quite big. So a number needed to treat of 4, you're talking about a 25% plus difference.
Yeah, and they sound very similar, although actually not quite as high as what we saw with the cannabinoids.
Yeah,
you know, and that's sort of to be expected because, I mean, these are very common, you know, that's kind of how these drugs work. They work on a variety of different things and different parts of your body. You know, although the one good thing, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this, the nice thing is that there's, other than obviously in major overdose where you can die from it, you know, long-term use of morphine, as far as I know, doesn't damage a part of your body. You know what I mean? It's not like alcohol where, you know, you have the chance of it, you know, really doing things to your liver and so on over long term. Or if you look at, you know, things like NSAIDs where it can, you know, definitely worsen heart failure. It can cause renal complications. Other than the sort of side effects that you get from just taking it at that time, it fortunately doesn't have any long-term side effects. Now, people are going, well, don't you know people get addicted to it? And,
absolutely.
I've heard that. And that certainly is an
issue.
I've heard that. Yeah. I read it in a book and it was in the newspaper once. But you know what I'm saying is that, and clearly you'll go through withdrawal, but it doesn't, you know, do long-term damage, if you will.
Other than it has been studied to increase your pain response, which I think is fascinating. There's some really interesting studies of patients going to surgery and being blinded. So half of them get a dose of morphine during surgery and half don't. And those that got morphine during surgery for the weeks that followed required more analgesia than those who didn't.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a fascinating adaptation that we go through when given these
narcotics.
I just think that it's so important for people to understand, you know, it's not just the addiction potential and then therefore all of the really serious consequences that come from it. These drugs are ranked lower also because they have a lot more adverse events than, and this is going to sound crazy, than Elavil, which is amitriptyline, nortriptyline, gabapentin, and drugs like that. It's just, and duloxetine. So these drugs are potentially more harmful and quite difficult to tolerate. So it's just it's an important reminder that although their effects are similar, their adverse events are higher.
And I would imagine because of the adverse effects, And I know when we talked about cannabinoids, it was very difficult to blind those trials.
Oh.
And I'd imagine this, to some degree, it's probably tricky in these ones as well.
Yeah, I would suspect so. We didn't look specifically at that, but it would be, I mean, there, it's almost certainly a problem because it's kind of like orlistat and some of these other drugs that their adverse event profile is so powerful that it's very easy to tell when you're on drug. So what do the guidelines say? So putting these things in context, they suggest SSRIs, TCAs, and gabapentin pregabalin as first line for neuropathic pain. And for all the reasons we just mentioned, their effects are as good as high dose opioids, and their adverse events are lower. And the recommendations for opioids really vary from never starting in primary care without specialist advice to putting them as second line therapy. So it's all over the map. I don't think that I would advocate for them for second line therapy. But I think they should really be one of, just as we talked about with cannabinoids, quite far down the list and maybe even behind cannabinoids.
I was going to ask you that. Like if you had this sort of pain, would you go with a medical marijuana first, or would you go with a narcotic?
Are you saying first in the sense of
if other things didn't work?
Forget acetaminophen.
Let's say other things didn't work. So, you know, I think especially with the problems that are going on with opioids in the last, ever since we got them.
I would literally try most other things first, including like all the other kind of therapy kind of things. And if you look at me right now, I have quite bad knee pain. You know that I've whined incessantly. You don't let me talk about it on the podcast,
it's given me a chronic ear pain.
I'm sure it has. But I'm doing physio for that and everything. And I'll be honest with you, my physio is a great guy. I hate doing home physio, but I do it because I don't want to take medications of any type. I hate adverse events. So, I would work pretty darn hard. What I would choose after that, I'm not sure. I've had to take low potency opioids before for severe pain for another thing, and I hated them.
Yeah,
I
interesting. Yeah.
It's fascinating how I can't understand how people tolerate them, and I'm not saying that's not something that should affect anyone's prescribing. What Mike Allen had happened to him for. And it's interesting, one of my colleagues also had to use them for a terrible pain problem and fortunately recovered entirely. But for those 2 weeks or so, just hated them.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. And
I'm in that boat. I would do just about anything to avoid taking any opioids because they, like even with something as little as codeine, I did not enjoy the all the adverse events that come with it.
And one nice thing about the other things that we've talked about, the things like the amitriptyline and the gabapentin, you can easily start with very low doses, and you probably should, because if you don't get any effect from those low doses, you're probably not going to get much of an effect. So you can almost, whereas with narcotics, you kind of have to work your way up until you get that balance between not being completely snowed and constipated and vomiting and getting some pain relief. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's one of the reasons I think it's legitimate to try these other things first, even though, and I think you'd agree with me, there are very few head-to-head comparisons, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think in the future we'll review the SPACE trial and the...
Mm-hmm. No, but I meant for neuropathic pain.
Yeah, for neuropathic pain, I don't think there is much. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. So let's just wrap up. It is important to recognize that 58% of all drug-related deaths are opioid-related. That data comes from Ontario, but it's pretty terrifying when you look at it, right? So don't want to. I mean, that's just one more reason to throw to throw into the pile of why we want to give these kind of as a last-ditch effort. So I think, it's not that they don't work. That's not what we're saying. It's just a lot of the studies used whopping doses. They had effects only similar, not better than what we would see in a lot of the other drugs, and the adverse events are quite high. So more than what we'd expect with other agents. And if you're interested in that kind of thing even more, James, and I think, you know, you had reminded me of this,
yeah, yeah.
We have a tool called Comparing Treatment Options for Pain that was funded with the help of the Alberta College of Family Physicians. And we've worked, Sean, who you found, is just great at developing these websites.
Yeah, and Sean Kane, just to get it, is a PharmD again, who is very, very good at putting or creating sort of a web-based helps us with our CBD calculators, and he did a great job of creating the pain calculator, which is at pain-calculator.com. And much of what we just talked about is sort of expressed in with happy faces and graphs and tables, and hopefully it would be a useful thing for people to use to compare all the different agents.
Right. So you can go there with your patient who's suffering from, we have other ones coming soon, but the neuropathic pain is already available, and you can show your patient what the chances of benefit. We've kind of set the placebo effect at a standard 25%, and the little green faces mark the benefit of different drugs. So if you click on pregabalin, it'll show you that the benefit over and above placebo is about 16% more will attain a clinically meaningful effect. And if you go to duloxetine, it's around 13. And that one's tricky because the placebo effect was high, so the calculation makes it look maybe not quite as good. But, you know, you look at amitriptyline and the TCAs, and it's 25%. And high-dose opioids is around somewhere around 18. So, you know, it's kind of right in that range of all of these drugs. It's certainly not a standout. And it has a lot of kind of constipation, 34%, 29% versus for sleepiness, 27% for nausea.
Yeah.
And so really important to take a look at that and realize that, you know, these other drugs like duloxetine, although it might have a slightly lower effect by the best guesstimate, it has a lot lower adverse event profile.
And the where this is very different than cardiovascular risk calculators, where you can never figure out if the person's going to benefit. It's just like basically a lottery system. But when it comes to this, you know, this is just a starting point, because you either get a 30% reduction in pain or you don't.
Right.
You know, it's not, well, you know, it's not, it's very different. And so the tool is just to give you, here's kind of what we know on average, but every person you try is sort of a guinea pig, if you will.
Yeah, and the tool, the way you read it is, so if you're looking at one of these interventions for amitriptyline, you can say one in every two patients, or 50% of patients, will get a meaningful reduction in their pain. They'll kind of go from a 6 out of 10 to a 4 out of 10, which likely has some functional implications. But out of that 50% who got improvement, only about half of them are actually due to the drug.
Yeah.
So now you don't necessarily need to go over all of that with the patient, but you need to let them know what are the context of them getting better and what are the chances of them getting better. And it should be also stated that from the best available evidence, neuropathic pain for at least 50% of patients requires two interventions to control adequately.
Yeah. No, it's difficult. For sure.
Yeah, for sure. So
anything else you want to talk about, Mike?
No, we'll have the links to the tools for practice and to the pain calculator on the website.
Yeah. So thanks to Joey and Danielle for doing all the work and for you taking the glory.
Yes, that's right. I like to do that.
And I don't think, you know, we're getting close to the summer, so let's not sell anything. You know, we're not going to sell your course, which is coming up in what month? Is it November? We're not going to sell it.
No, we're not going to sell it. Not that it's occurring in October.
October, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great time to visit Edmonton. We're not going to push that though.
No. Or the one in Vancouver in May, because
we won't even mention that. Let's not mention that one.
No, that's a good idea.
About how good it is.
Yeah. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.